welcome to Podfications 2019 live performances event. Yay! For folks at home listening, we're a convention for podfic creators and listeners, and you can learn more about us at podfication.dreamwith.org. Tonight we're going to be listening to a variety of performances by our attendees across many ships, genres, and fandoms. For folks in the room, as always, we are recording these, so please do laugh, clap, participate, but please also silence your phones and avoid side conversations. Might want to check the phone thing now, shh, just to be sure. Thank you very much. With that, let's bring up our first reader, who is Bess.
Tonight, I am Bessie Boo. I mean, I'm Bessie Boo every night, but I continue to be Bessie Boo. And tonight, I am reading Power Fist and Cinnamon Roll Skywalker, which is written by Tumblr and read by me, Bessie Boo. Clone T Troopers writes, I'm just imagining an AU where Padme's pregnancy didn't have to be a secret, and Anakin is trying to pick out names for the baby, so he asks his men for ideas. And the clones, of course, throw out names like Zapper, Sling, Bomber, Kickback. Anakin is internally screaming, but he doesn't want to insult them by saying those are terrible names, so he's just like, thanks, guys. RCE Archive blog adds, are you kidding? If anyone would give their kid a name like Kickback, it would be Anakin. Better Be Meta says, even better is if after the kids are born, there are still clones around for security and such, and when they're old enough to talk, they know they were given names by their parents, but clones see those names as like your technical slash official ID, not as your actual personal name. So they talk to these little kids who, of course, love preposterous names, and that's how Leia is also named Power Fist. Angel Queen 04 adds, dear God, the twins would have, like, hundreds of doting uncles. It would be so awesome. And that demon boy puts in, I've reblogged this before, but imagine Luke being dubbed Cinnamon Roll by the clones. Fox Rensler runs with this, saying, Cinnamon Roll, get off the X-Wing! Your father will kill us if you fall! Marlovian Devil declares, Power Fist and Cinnamon Roll Skywalker. Deal. And Tactus Watt joins in, and then Rex is just like, for shit's sake, guys. Rose Stone Writes comes in. Oh my god, so I was just gonna tag Spiral about this, but I have too many thoughts. So I'm gonna actually write real text for once. So, here we have Power Fist Leia Skywalker and Cinnamon Roll Luke Skywalker. They probably spend a lot of time with the clones, right? Because if Padme and Anakin aren't in a secret relationship, TM, then Anakin probably doesn't fall. So the war doesn't end the way it does in canon. Actually, shit, I forgot about Rule 6, Order 66. Actually, this just says 66. 66. So let's say Palps tries to recruit Anakin anyway because he's super powerful and Palps wants that on his side, but Anakin betrays him to the council and so Order 66 doesn't happen. But just because Palpatine tripped and fell into about a dozen lightsabers on his way to jail cell doesn't mean the war's over. The Separatists are fucked. They can't exactly claim that Sidious made them do it, so they're going to try their hardest not to lose. So Anakin's still spending a lot of time out in the field, and Padme's still got Senate stuff to do. And they probably both already had serious business security details, since somebody needs to be around whenever Anakin decides to do something really fucking stupid without backup. He usually manages without backup, but Obi-Wan, Padme, and every clone friend of Anakin's agree that they'd rather have someone on him anyway. And Padme's a significant target for the Separatists because A, she's pretty well connected in the Senate, and B, Palps was hoping he could kill her off to get Anakin to fall. Which would have ended pretty badly for him, but Palpatine clearly doesn't understand love, so he wouldn't have realized that. So, Anakin gets called off to spearhead some campaign somewhere, Padme has to go to the Senate, and who's left to look after Power Fist and Cinnamon Roll? Padme finds these names hilarious, by the way. It's the clones. Okay, Rex says, no longer quite so angry about being grounded while his blaster wound heals. Watch carefully. This is how you hold a blaster, okay? Luke and Leia are fascinated. Padme, who entered politics at a frankly ridiculous age and was embroiled in her first war at the age of 14, isn't all that upset when she finds out. Okay, she'd prefer it if the weaponry lessons waited until the kids were older, but considering who their parents are, they're pretty tempting kidnap targets, so she'd rather they knew how to look after themselves. And they're so cute doing their unarmed combat lessons. Anakin is very protective of his tiny children. He's seen some shitty stuff in the galaxy, okay? He just wants to wrap them in cotton wool and hide them somewhere until they're 18. He is not impressed when he finds out. Every stupid, dangerous thing he ever did as a child is running through his head on a loop. He did so many stupid things. Not that many, Padme says, patting his shoulder. Pod races, Anakin says hoarsely. Blowing up Trade Federation droid ships, racing speeders, sticking my hands into droid innards. That isn't dangerous, Padme says, frowning. What if I'd electrocuted myself? Anakin demands. I could have died so many ways, Padme. Why did I pass this on to my children? Oh, God. Padme looks over at Rex for support. He's never told you any of the really wild war stories, has he? Rex says, deadpan. They're too short to fly fighters, but we can start them on acrobatics soon. They'll have an easier time if they've already had practice not throwing up the first time one of them decides to spin the ship they're flying. I'll take that into consideration, Padme says, wondering what Anakin's stories are if they aren't the wild ones. Somewhere, Obi-Wan Kenobi just broke a rib laughing. The end.
And the Kitchen Sink. A Marvel Cinematic Universe fic. Written by Danik and read by Dr. Fumbles McStupid. Text message. Foggy Nelson. Wade, can you do me a favor? Wade, you have a text message, Peter told the man himself under the sink. All he could see were his legs and abs through the haze of pure hatred emanating from the cabinet. What Wade needed to do was hire a professional to fix his house. What Wade would never in a million years do was hire a professional to fix his house. He called it a paranoia thing and said it was fine. He was learning new skills all the time and that eventually things got fixed. Peter was pretty sure skill meant that you had to be good at something. By this definition, Wade was learning only how to frustrate himself into oblivion, not to actually fix things. Nevertheless, he watched the legs and didn't mention that his uncle had taught him basic plumbing when he was like 9. Wade, you have a text message, he repeated in case Wade hadn't heard him over the clanking in his ears. Read it out to me, Wade told him, while screwing what Peter decided was probably a washer back into place. One of his hands snaked out from the netherworld and felt around the pile of grimy tools on the towel for a better wrench. Peter opened Wade's phone because he was an idiot sometimes and 4445 was not a passcode. It's from Mr. Nelson, he said. He's asking if you can do him a favor. A wrench dropped under the sink and Wade jerked. The whole sink rattled and groaned and he swore. Ask him if he can fix a fucking sink. Peter pursed his lips and typed out the message. Foggy Nelson. Can we make a trade instead of a favor if I fix your sink? He says he knows and wants to know if you want to trade favors, Peter announced. Wade wriggled out from the cabinet covered in years of nasty sink contagions. He turned around to wash his hands, then remembered his sink was a piece of shit and had to brace his arms and forehead against it to contain the aggravation. Yes. Tell him yes. Foggy Nelson. On my way. Mr. Nelson knocked on the door while Wade was in the bathroom, scrubbing grime off his arms and the only functional sink in the apartment. Peter answered it and waved and let Mr. Nelson in. Or Foggy, rather. It was a weekend, and Mr. Nelson had feelings about names. Namely, that Peter and his buddies could call him Foggy almost all of the time now. None of them, Peter, MJ, or Ned, could bring themselves to do this, however, because Mr. Nelson was an adult. One of the adultiest adults they knew. He had all kinds of adult knowledge, like what was a good price for tires and what a pound felt like in the hand. Peter loved his aunt dearly, but she knew neither of these things. She was the lady in the produce section who abused her scale privileges. Foggy gave Peter a smile and immediately wove his way around the couches over to the sink. He poked around at its faucet and basins, then crouched to get a better look under it. He set the toolbox he'd brought with him down and flushed out a flashlight to locate the problem. It's fucking leaking, Wade groused, having emerged from his bird bath. I can see that, Foggy noted patiently. The mold culture in there is 2 days from staging a fucking coup, Wade grumped. I've changed all the hardware and bought the fucking blue goop that smells like ass, but the fucker is just determined to breed the next supervirus. Foggy made a contemplative noise as he examined Wade's handiwork. Peter resumed sitting on the back of the couch, swinging his legs. It probably looked like a kindergartner's craft project down there. The only things missing were the glue and feathers. Wade leaned against the couch next to him, put out for having to give in to a pro. Wade didn't usually care about stuff like that, but for some reason, the inability to successfully complete home improvement projects grated on his nerves like nothing else. Peter wouldn't dare point out that the root of the problem was the fact that he had no idea what the fuck he was doing, just on the off chance Wade developed the need to make a bomb to compensate for the loss. You need a new sink, Foggy diagnosed. Wade crossed his arms irritably. I don't need a new sink. I just need a fucking handbook or some shit. You need a new sink, Foggy maintained. You still have the model number? If not, that's fine. We can probably find you something similar. I don't need a new sink. Foggy gave him a look Peter had never seen directed at anyone but Matt before. It usually incited hissing and strategic retreat on that front. Wade, your basin is cracked. Suck it up. You need a new sink. Wade made a frustrated grunt and pressed his fingers into his forehead. Is there any way? Nope. Are you? Yup. Ugh. Wade slid down the back of the couch and hung his head between his legs on the floor. I can get you one today, if you don't mind it not being the exact same model, Foggy offered. We can install it this evening. Shouldn't take too long. Are you a plumbing angel? Wade asked in defeat from the floor. Peter swung his foot just a little too close by accident, and Wade grabbed it and made him fall back over the sofa. Foggy huffed out an amused laugh at the two of them. No, boo, I'm just the heir to Nelson's Hardware and Home Improvement. Foggy dragged them all the way to Hell's Kitchen to introduce Peter, Wade, and Wade's misery to his honest-to-God father. And the man was so nice. He didn't look anything like Foggy, balding as he was with dark eyes and big ears. But he held out his hand and asked Peter if he wanted a soda. He didn't, but Foggy's dad either hadn't heard or couldn't process that and went off to find one to shove into his hands anyway. Your sister is a menace, he informed Foggy, while Wade rubbed his hands all over every model of sink in the store. It was a considerable variety for it being a mom-and-pop place. It was a bit bigger shop than Peter would have thought, too, although that might have been the narrow aisles. It smelled like freshly cut wood and paint chips. From the looks of it, Foggy's family lived upstairs and worked down. Water is wet, Foggy observed. The boy she's dating is one of them hipsters, one of those kids into micro or macro or, I don't know, some fancy kind of beer. Foggy appeared to be weighing this information against an image of his sister in his head. Yeah, that sounds about right. You have a sister? Peter asked to avoid drinking any more grape soda. Half-sister, technically. She's younger than me, off in college right now. Her name is Candace. And she's bisexual, Foggy's dad added earnestly. Foggy sighed and rubbed his face. Peter bit the inside of his cheek and nodded in interest. Dad, you don't need to tell everyone that, Foggy groaned to the concrete flooring. I liked her last girlfriend better, you know. She was a nice girl. What was her name? Tanya? Tony? Tula, Dad. She was Greek. And can you not with the bisexual thing? Why not? What's the matter with bisexuals now? Your mom read an article the other day, said more people are bisexual than not. Speaking of which, where's our Matthew? He's a nice boy too, Matthew. Can't fix a damn thing, but he's pretty enough to get by. For the love of Dad, here, what's come in today? Are you lifting shit again? What shit can I lift for you? Peter was pretty sure if he punctured his cheek if this kept up, so he took a sip of the offensive soda and redirected his attention to Wade, who was petting a handleless model with reverence. Peter knew without asking he was thinking of all the blood he wouldn't have to wash off the handles. She's this one, Wade murmured tearfully. Nelson, what do I owe you? Wade asked as he turned the new sink on and off in awe. Peter would admit that it was a much better sink. It looked very sleek, despite all of the punk rock and grunge kitsch in Wade's kitchen. Oh, right. Can you go separate Maddie and Jess? They're doing something nefarious and both lying to me about it, Foggy said. Peter wondered if they both weren't already dead, given the 3 hours they'd just dedicated to dealing with Wade's kitchen. Sure thing, chicken wing. Where are they? Wade asked. He turned off the sink for good and went to go grab his coat. No clue, Foggy said, arms folded, shoulders slumping. They were having too good of a time, though, on the last call, so hopefully passed out in a ditch somewhere. as Daredevil and, nope, just as morons, fought each other. The harder we try to keep them apart, the more determined they are to be together. Peter had originally thought that Double D and Jessica Jones were an unlikely set of buddies, but the more he saw them together, the more their unfortunate friendship made sense. They were both snarky assholes who bled angst and rage, and both had a propensity for creeping on people without their permission. They were also both infuriatingly intelligent and incapable of not spouting off in the face of authority. Through this, Peter assumed they'd fallen into their dysfunctional love and best friendhood. Jessica said, jump, and Matt said, bet you can't higher than me, and Jessica said, wanna fucking bet, asshole, and they were off. Peter had only experienced the true horror of their duo a handful of times, and every single one of them had been perfectly awful. And Matt had been shit-faced for all of them because he was terrifyingly susceptible to Jessica's bad influences. It had come abruptly to Peter's attention on the first of those occasions that drunk Matt was not a drunk Double D. He was just a drunk Matt. And that posed some problems. Peter joined Wade in hunting the two of them down because it wasn't like he had anything better to do, and he felt like he needed to pay Foggy back for the soda his dad had refused to let him pay for. He also really didn't want a drunk Matt out attempting to conduct Double D business for the sake of himself and the city. They found the two giggling and shushing each other loudly in an alley by the docks, attempting, poorly, to menace some drug dealers out of the city. It was working by sheer virtue of them being more or less coordinated, and therefore more dangerous, intoxicated than sober. The drug dealers threw in the already frantically waving towel at the arrival of Deadpool and Spider-Man, and Wade flipped a coin, and Peter got stuck with the task of half-dragging, half-carrying Jessica Jones back to the city proper. She allowed this to the extent that she let Peter move her, although this was made difficult by her trying to hold Matt's hand, and him doing his damnedest to keep her from doing that for no reason that Peter or Wade could discern. They were slurring too hard to understand what was going on. The only thing Wade could get out of them was cooties. And Jessica, making a lewd gesture, which made Matt laugh so hard he cried. The news that they were going home and not together was met with staunch resistance. They ended up dropping Jessica off with her former associate and Trish Walker first. Trish Walker pointed at Matt and called him a menace and a bad influence. He responded to these accusations by growling at her finger. Jessica told him she missed him already, and he called her a wench and a whore, and it was her turn to be incoherent with laughter. Foggy accepted his idiot with grace and sobered him up a bit with sternly pointed silence. No more getting drunk with Jess, he stipulated while Matt fidgeted with the edges of his coat guiltily. You didn't even take the soup, Matthew. If someone had seen you, we'd all be fucked. Matt wouldn't look up into his face, but Foggy took the uncomfortable squirming as affirmation. Bed, he said simply. No, drunk Matt whined like a kid. It's bed or self-induced vomiting. The ball's in your court, pal. Matt pouted and groaned and extricated himself from Wade to drape himself all over Foggy in apology. Foggy sighed and wrapped him in a hug with his arms locked in the small of Matt's back. He let Matt burrow into his neck. It was a rare public show of intimacy between the two of them, although cheapened by Foggy's obvious exasperation. He thanked Wade and Peter for bringing Matt home and told Wade to call him if the sink didn't work again. They heard him sigh again just as the door closed. Text message from Wade Wilson. Hey, Nelson, can you do me a favor? The end.
I'm Semper Viona, and this is Dr. Seuss Goes to Hogwarts. Written by Elfrek. That pervy Chan, that pervy Chan, I do not like that pervy Chan. Do you like sex with a man? I do not like that pervy Chan, I do not like sex with a man. Would you like it in a bed? I would not like it in a bed, not even if he gave me head. I do not like sex with a man, I am not gay, no pervy Chan. Would you like it after class? Get yourself some student ass. I do not want it after class. I do not want some student ass. I do not want it in a bed, not even if he gives me head. I do not like sex with a man. I am not gay. No pervy Chan. Would you do it for a potion? Just a hand job with some lotion. Not with lotion, not for a potion, not after class, no student ass. I do not want it in a bed, not even if he gives me head. I do not like sex with a man. I am not gay. No pervy Chan. Would you, could you, with the twins? Fuck them. Suck them, see them grin. I would not, could not with the twins. You may like them, you may say. You may like some finger play. I do not want some finger play, not with the twins, not go away. I would not do it for a potion. I would not give hand jobs with lotion. I do not like it after class. I do not want some student ass. I do not want it in a bed, not even if he gives me head. I do not like sex with a man. I am not gay, no pervy chan. The flu. Could you in the flu? Not in the flu, no finger play. Not with the twins, now go away. I would not, could not, for a potion. I would not, could not, with some lotion. I will not do it after class. I will not chase some student ass. I will not do it in a bed, not even if he gives me head. I do not like sex with a man. I am not gay, no pervy chan. Say, in a cell, here, in a cell. Could you, in a cell? I would not, could not, in a cell. Could you, Pettigrew? I would not, could not, with Pettigrew. Not in a cell, not in the flu. Not with the twins, no finger play. I lost my place. Not with the twins, now go away. I will not do it for a potion. I will not like it with some lotion. I will not do it after class. I do not want some student ass. I do not like it in a bed, not even if he gives me head. I do not like sex with a man. I am not gay, no pervy chan. You do not like it. Harry's here. Try him, he is queer. Try him, 'cause he's queer, my dear. If you go away, you dunce. I will try it just this once. Say, I like sex with a man. I do. I like this pervy chan. And I would do it without hope. And I would do it with some rope. And I will go fuck Pettigrew inside a cell in the flu. I'll show the twins some finger play. I'll wear them out. They'll run away. And I will do it for a potion. And I'll give hand jobs with some lotion. And I will do it after class, get myself some student ass. And I will do it in a bed, and we'll just see who's giving head. I do so like sex with a man. Send me all that pervy chat.
Thank you. That's the end.
The Demonic Cryptid Hellboy, read by Forzantopod as the narrator.
Opal Song as Ryan.
The Lane and She as Liz.
And Revolutionary Joe as Shane.
Pairings, the one pairing in this is Liz Hellboy.
Ryan and Shane are in a car, driving in the country outside Newark, New Jersey.
You gonna be okay on this one? You look a little pale.
You know how I feel about demons.
Does Hellboy count as a demon, though? Isn't he more of a cryptid?
His name starts with Hell. That's enough for me.
I'm not sure you can count this as your one demon per season.
Yes, we sure can.
We'll let the comments decide.
I hate you.
Title sequence. Ryan and Shane behind their usual desk.
Welcome to another episode of BuzzFeed Unsolved. Today we're looking into a modern cryptid. The elusive Hellboy.
An appropriate montage of images flashes across the screen as Ryan narrates.
The legend of the creature known as Hellboy goes back to the end of the Second World War. Numerous accounts from government agencies all over the world report that towards the end of the war, Hitler, in his desperation, turned towards the occult as an attempt to secure some kind of supernatural Hail Mary.
Scrolling text.
Wait, this story has Nazis in it?
This story has Nazis.
I hope they die.
They do.
I hope they get sucked right into hell, like a whoosh. No, more like a toilet sound, like a whoosh.
I think they just get shot. Like, with bullets.
Oh, that's good, too.
Back to narration.
Sightings of Hellboy began a few years later, but it wasn't until the 1980s when Rhonda Whitman wrote an article about Hellboy that quickly went viral in cryptozoological circles that the connection was made between the two. In her article, Whitman wrote about stories that her grandfather, a war veteran, told her. She writes, quote, "My grandfather told me stories about a top-secret mission at the end of the war on a small British island. The enemy was trying to open a portal to hell itself. We took them by surprise. We killed them all, but not before they opened the door and brought something through." A young man, a British consultant, not even a soldier, convinced them not to kill it. The squad named it Hellboy. Unquote.
Cut to Ryan and Shane outside of their car, now on the side of the road, next to the woods.
We're in New Jersey, just outside Newark. This is where our contact told us was the best place to look.
A shame we couldn't go back to England. I'd like to find that island with all the dead Nazis.
Let me check my inventory. I've got my holy water, my pistol, my salt.
I brought a six-pack of Pilsner.
You're bringing beer for a demon?
Absolutely. He seems like a cool guy.
Cut to voiceover.
Since the late 50s, sightings of Hellboy have been reported worldwide. One of the most unique and baffling aspects of Hellboy is that he almost always appears in or near locations that already report supernatural infestations. For example, he was seen several years ago outside a small town in Romania that was the rumored home of a nest of murderous vampires. Eyewitness accounts are consistent when describing Hellboy. They say he has red skin, a tail, feet like cleft hooves, a large right hand made of, or possibly encased in, some kind of stone, and red circles on his forehead. Some people think they're goggles, but the greater agreement among witnesses is that they're actually the stubs of horns that have been cut or sanded off.
Cut to Ryan and Shane behind their desk.
That's badass. Sanding off your own horns? Badass.
I'm more disturbed by the notion.
What? You should find it comforting.
How should I find self-mutilation comforting?
Horns are the number one cartoon shorthand for evil. No horns equals no evil.
Except this isn't a cartoon. It's real.
Is it though?
That's what we're here to find out.
It's not called BuzzFeed Solved, Ryan.
Narration.
We were approached several months ago by one eyewitness who wanted to offer their testimony. After corresponding back and forth, she agreed to be interviewed on camera.
Inside a coffee shop, Ryan and Shane are sitting across from a woman with black hair. She has a cold cup of coffee in front of her.
Thanks for meeting us. I'm Ryan, this is Shane, and you're Elizabeth Sherman?
Just Liz, please.
I hope you haven't been waiting here long.
Not long, no.
You sounded reluctant to meet initially. Can I ask what made you change your mind?
I don't really like being on camera usually, but my boyfriend really encouraged me. I probably know more on the topic than anyone alive. Plus, he just thought it'd be hilarious.
Why isn't your boyfriend here with you?
Best if he's not. Trust me.
Liz takes a sip from her coffee, which is now steaming.
So, what's your history with Hellboy? What can you share with us?
I can't give you the details, but I have access and thorough knowledge on Hellboy, going back many years.
So, like a library?
There's a library involved, yes.
What's some information that you think is missing from the larger Hellboy conversation?
Well, he loves cats.
Ryan narration.
Let's jump into our theories. Theory 1. There isn't just one Hellboy, but rather an entire species with a similar enough appearance to all be mistaken for the same creature. This would explain the worldwide sightings. While some people online argue this theory very strongly, I personally find it unlikely, considering how much agreement there is in witness statements as to the appearance and behavior of Hellboy. There also has never been a single sighting of more than one Hellboy together, which you think would be inevitable if this theory were true.
Back to the interview.
What do you think of the theory that there's more than one Hellboy in the world? Because I, for one, think one is enough.
One is definitely enough. Can you imagine? The secret would be out within an hour.
What do you mean?
You heard about the time he signed an autograph in a public park? Or the kid in New York who said they ate cookies together and talked about girls? He's not exactly good at keeping a low profile, is what I'm saying.
I have not heard these stories. Ryan, why haven't I heard these stories yet? Are you getting soft?
I was saving them for later.
No point now. You missed the boat. And I didn't bring my autograph book. I didn't bring cookies.
Narration.
Theory 2. Unlike most demonic manifestations, which lack a permanent corporeal body, Hellboy, because he came through an open portal, exists only physically in our world and has to travel the way humans do. Though how he is able to travel and be seen all over the world using only conventional means opens further questions. He would need help, a wide network of accomplices, or a far-reaching conspiracy.
Cut to Ryan and Shane behind their desk.
You mean a government conspiracy?
I'm just saying, a lot of resources would have to be involved. Private airplanes, accommodations, food. I mean, who knows what this guy eats? We're talking big bucks here.
I can get on board with a good old-fashioned government conspiracy. I bet there's an entire bureau. A bureau for paranormal research.
And defense, I hope? If my taxpayers' money is going to this, they better be keeping me safe, not making it worse.
I don't know, man. Have you seen the news?
Maybe it's so secret that even the chuckleheads in D.C. don't know about them.
Ooh, I like that. It makes me feel better. It shouldn't, but it honestly makes me feel better.
Walking through the woods.
Because of Hellboy's international MO, it's hard to know where to look for him. Liz told us this was the best place, and we're taking her word for it.
Ryan, narrating.
At this point, our camera picks up the sound of a splash.
Cut to scrolling text.
I'm going to have to stop you right there. A splash is not a ghost. It's not a demon. It's a fish.
I'm just presenting the evidence for the audience to interpret.
They don't have to interpret. I'm doing it for them. It's a fish.
I'd just like to point out that the river was very cold. Cold enough to throw off our thermal cameras if, say, a warm-blooded demon were to jump in.
You know what else is warm-blooded? A fish.
That is literally not true. I thought you were the science one.
Cut back to the woods.
I guess it's time to bring out the spirit box. Though, I'm not sure this is the best use for it.
Can we please not?
If the theory that Hellboy exists as a corporeal entity in our world is true, then it's useless. It would be like using the spirit box to look for Bigfoot.
Which we didn't do. I know. Let's pour one out for the big guy, huh?
And waste your beers? Why didn't you bring more?
I brought a six-pack.
Then why are there only two?
What are you talking about?
Shane swings off his big backpack. Two beers are hanging off of a strap near the outside bottom of the backpack. The plastic rings that should be holding the other four beers are empty.
Huh.
What? Huh? That's it?
Don't freak out on me.
Oh, I skipped right over freaking out. I went straight into mind-numbing terror.
They were probably snagged off on a tree.
Wouldn't you have noticed that?
Well, sure, then I guess it was definitely a demon. I'm glad there's no in-between. Makes things easier. A demon stole my beer.
Oh my god! Oh my god.
Wait, no it didn't. I brought the beer for Hellboy. It's not stealing when they're already his.
Oh my god, shut up!
Cut interview with Liz.
What do you think we can expect from our search for Hellboy, if we should find him?
Trolling. I mean, pranks, for sure.
He's a prankster? Fun.
Not on the job. I mean, it's not what he's known for. But what can you expect if you look for him? Definitely trolling.
Why us?
Yeah, I don't like the idea of special attention.
You wouldn't?
I don't!
Would you be offended if I called you small time?
Not at all!
We're the smallest time. Any smaller and time starts moving backwards.
So if you were big time, he couldn't afford to mess with you, but small time.
But how will he know that we're coming?
What makes you think he doesn't watch your show?
Cut back to the woods.
I can't believe I'm actually in the woods with a demon. I'm going to die. I don't have a will.
Oh, it's fine. Let's spirit box.
You just said we shouldn't.
I changed my mind. I'm a mercurial guy.
I hate this. I hate this.
Ryan pulls out the spirit box and turns it on. Narration.
Strangely, our camera caught several noises during the spirit box session that came from the surroundings around us, not from the box itself. I will point them out as best I can, but many of the sounds were covered or muffled by noises of the spirit box.
Spirit box shrieks.
Am I in contact with a demon called Hellboy?
Hey boy, did you steal my beers?
At this point, we hear a sound that could be a beer can opening. Did you hear that?
What? Just do the box thing.
Okay, I can do this. My name is Ryan. This is Shane. Can you say our names back to us?
So I hear you've been around the world. Where's the best vacation spot?
Here, there was a rustling in the woods behind us. Do you hear that?
We're in a forest. Sounds happen. What do you want me to say? It's probably bears?
Not helping!
Check the thermal.
Okay, this is fine. It's fine. Holy shit, there's something there!
What? It's a lump.
Are you seeing this? There's something there!
Could still be a bear. Or some forest hobo. Let's go.
Please be a forest hobo! Please be a forest hobo!
Great. Nothing. Check the thermal again.
Nothing. Wait, do you hear that? Another splash!
Forest hobo taking a swim?
What's that?
What's what?
There, on that tree. There's something written on it.
It says, "Hey boys, it's me, ya demon."
Nope, I'm out. Get me out, I'm out of here.
We haven't walked around alone yet.
Don't even joke about that.
I'm still down. Oh, look, there's the empty beer cans on the ground.
I'm leaving!
Narration.
Could this be our most convincing evidence yet? Or was there a forest hobo? Or maybe some local rowdies in the woods messing with us? Either way, the existence of the demon known as Hellboy will remain unsolved.
Like, we didn't get the author name on there, I don't think.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
That was written by Seer.
Yeah, written by Seer.
Alright. Avengers, you've been chopped. 10 travels by America's Asset. Summary. Bucky nodded. Last night, Steve had a nightmare that Alex Guarnaschelli told him he'd been cooking potatoes wrong his whole life and took his cast iron skillet away. Never did get back to sleep. Notes. More drabbles about how the Avengers can't be trusted to have TV obsessions. This certainly won't be the last. How is there a whole channel about food? What part of the concept is tripping you up? Sam looked at Steve like there couldn't possibly be anything weird about that. It's food, Sam. There can't possibly be that much to say about it. It's mostly cooking competitions. Why is everything a competition now? Whined Steve. It's just food. Clint appeared seemingly out of nowhere. You've clearly never watched anyone try to beat Bobby Flay. Sam shoved Steve in the direction of the TV. Come on, old man. I think Kids Baking Championship is on. You'll love it. There are championships? Bucky stood in the doorway and watched Steve watch TV. How is there a whole channel about food? Steve chuckled. I asked the exact same thing. It's mostly cooking competition shows. Competition? What, like who can make the most? Who's the fastest? Experts eat the food and judge it. People get paid to eat food? On screen, people in blue and red aprons took notes as someone butchered the chicken. What's this one? This is Worst Cooks in America. Steve patted the couch cushion. Come on, it's funny and educational. Bucky plopped down with a sigh. The future is weird. Oh my God, how long have you all been drinking? Steve, the only sober Avenger in the room, had never seen Pepper look quite so disappointed. It's a marathon, slurred Tony, and Tony's slurring was a sure sign this had gotten way out of control. Beat Bobby Flay. They bet shots on who will make it to the second round and if they'll beat Bobby, explained Steve, like this was all perfectly logical. Sam fell off the couch. It's Thai food. I bet 3 shots Bobby's gonna lose. Pepper sighed. If the world could see its mightiest heroes right now. Cooking? Come on, there's a good movie on, whined Scott. At least the Alien show had only been a Friday night thing. Which movie? Asked Clint. From Russia with Love. Natasha and Bucky both shot pointed looks in Scott's direction. He only barely flinched. Classic James Bond, come on, you guys don't even cook. Maybe I'd side with you if it was Goldfinger, and if we weren't watching Triple G, said Clint. He's gonna make him use the little carts. I bet $10. $20, he lets them go, but does a red light special, says Steve. You're on. The kitchen echoed with the sound of blades against wood. Barnes has her on quantity, hands down, said Rhodey, his voice almost a whisper. Maybe, but consistency is a factor, replied Clint. Speed isn't everything. 15 seconds, called Bruce, eyeing the timer. The chopping noises grew even more furious. The timer beeped. Natasha and Bucky stepped away from the cutting boards. No, Rogers, put the scale down. You're biased, said Nat. Rhodey should do the weigh-in. I only needed a cup of diced onions, sighed Wanda from the back of the room. Can I please finish cooking now? After 5 minutes of Steve noisily rifling through the kitchen, Bucky had had enough. Is something wrong in there? We don't have enough knives. Steve slammed the drawer, which Bucky thought wasn't possible. Drawers which slowly and silently eased themselves shut was one of his favorite things about the future. We need a full set. Alton Brown said, yeah, that's what I've been saying too. More knives. Steve appeared in the doorway wearing an Iron Chef apron. I mean chef's knives. Bucky shrugged. I'm not picky. Not tactical knives. Anything's tactical if you know what you're doing, Stevie. No, Bucky. Sam sidled up to Natasha, following her gaze to the conference room down the hall. What's Fury so pissed off about? She smirked. Quinjets are not to be used for food-themed recreational outings. Don't tell me Bard managed to get caught. Red-handed, literally. I hear there was barbecue sauce all over the controls. I thought Tic Tac went with him. The conference room banged open, and a suitably contrite-looking Clint stomped past, Scott in tow. Does this mean next week's Triple D fried seafood extravaganza is canceled? Fuck off, Natasha. She laughed. You promised me fresh calamari. You okay, pal? Bucky didn't like the panicked look in Steve's eyes. The barefoot Contessa says if I can't make my own rose water, it's fine to use store-bought. But someone on Cupcake Wars said that the bottled stuff tastes too perfumey. But then Alton Brown says not to make rose water out of roses that aren't organically grown. And I don't think the florists around here know enough about where their roses come from to guarantee that I'm not going to get tainted rose petals. And wait, Steve, hold on a second. What the fuck is rose water? What's to complain about? Clint bit into another lemon basil mini muffin, courtesy of Steve using basil he grew on his own windowsill. The kitchen is constantly filthy, said Pepper. Scott burned herself trying to do that pan flip thing and almost cut his finger off, added Bruce, twice. Bucky nodded. Last night, Steve had a nightmare that Alex Guarnicelli told him he'd been cooking potatoes wrong his whole life and took his cast iron skillet away. Never did get back to sleep. Hey, at least now we know who here is allergic to shellfish, said Clint. That's good, right? Where is everyone? Thor looked around, clearly worried about the lack of activity. Only Vision and Wanda were there, curled up on the couch. Most everyone has been affected by a foodborne illness, said Vision. All of the Avengers have fallen ill? Were they poisoned? Wanda chuckled. I told them it was a bad idea to use the leftovers in the fridge as a mandatory ingredient for their cooking competition. That fried rice was a week old at least. In the end, I think they all got chopped. Vision smiled. On the positive side, it's been pleasantly quiet all day. Notes. Next time, HGTV.
The end.
Hello. I'm God of Laundry Baskets, and I'm reading Informed Consent and Other Cosmic Ironies by Kiara Sayre. And this is a Magnus Archives. Okay. Dear Timothy Stoker, thank you for submitting your qualitative research protocol to the Research Ethics Council, as we have only recently begun requiring oral history projects, such as those done at the Magnus Institute, to receive ethical approval. We understand this process may be unfamiliar. I have been assigned to help with your application. Your application for research ethics approval has been flagged for significant revision before it can go to the full Oversight Council. Please address the following points in your revision. 1. Most oral history interviews pose minimal, if any, risk to the subject. However, you have reported potential risk to the subjects for this project as all of them. Please elaborate. 2. Under compensation to the research subjects, you have responded, Martin once got guilted into paying some lady who saw a ghost. This amount was, quote, enough to pay for a coffee, but not, like, a nice coffee? Not a macchiato or anything like that, but maybe she takes it black. But he's just a pushover. We don't pay for statements. While all compensation must be reported for ethical review, compensation should also be standardized. If your budget does not allow for consistent compensation, then entry into raffles are allowed. 3. Oral history interviews are considered, for the purpose of ethical review, to be semi-structured interviews. While semi-structured interviews may deviate from the interview protocol, we do ask that you include any general questions you expect to ask every participant in said interview protocol. In light of this, please elaborate your interview protocol to include more than only statement begins. 4. You have indicated that this research is sponsored. For the purposes of ethics committee, a sponsor is, quote, the company, institution, or organization assuming overall responsibility for the initiation and management of the study. We are unable to locate any such company, institution, or organization as the beholding, and Eldritch Horror is not an acceptable classification for such an organization. Eldritch Horror or not, please provide, at a minimum, a phone number, email, and mailing address. 5. In your theoretical rationale, you have a 7-page section titled, Maybe We'd All Be Better Off If We Didn't Know Things After All. Wow, this is a shockingly well-researched polemic decrying empiricism and advocating quite persuasively in favor for relativistic epistemologies. It is misplaced in this application. Additionally, your citation of Firebrand 1975 is missing from the works cited. 6. A series of 7 question marks is not an acceptable study flowchart. 7. Under the section for study keywords, you have included assorted grotesqueries and fuck off spooky shit. These are not acceptable scholarly keywords. 8. Fuck if I know, but it's probably not great, is not an acceptable research objective. While there are more revisions that can be made, I thought perhaps it best if we stop there for now. On a personal note, I would urge you to take this process more seriously, Mr. Stoker. While all of us qualitative researchers know the pain of chasing grant money, referring to grant-giving organizations as eldritch horrors is a bit beyond the pale. Please submit these revisions as soon as possible and reach out if you have any questions. The end.
All right, welcome back to part two of live performance, or act two, I guess, of live performances 2019. So,
let's get started. All right, this is the true story of the worst dance party in history, a ruining history fic written by Be the Change and read by
Cantorina as Sarah, Bessie Boo as Ryan,
Miss Marina 95 as Curly,
X-Man Hater as Kelsey,
and Revolutionary Joe as Shane. Have you ever been to a party that went on a little too long? Maybe your feet hurt and you're pretty sure someone spiked the jungle juice with club drugs and you just want to go home and go to sleep. But you're out with that one friend who thinks if you don't go hard to terrible EDM until 3 a.m., you might as well be dead?
Honey, that's every party I've been to in WeHo.
Okay, this sounds like a call out for me specifically.
The EDM thing is a little on the nose.
I'm sorry I don't want to listen to three middle-aged white dudes mumbling into a mic about their sad divorces, Shane. I'm sorry I like fun.
Anyway, this week on the season 2 premiere of Ruining History, we're talking about the worst dance party in history. This story's got everything. Medical malpractice, misogyny, bespoke candles.
Box!
Yeah, probably, if you like lutes and virginals.
Whoa, hey, TMI there, dude.
Virginals, you idiot, not virgins. They're like a little keyboard harp thing.
I mean, either way you want to pluck them.
Is it just going to be this all day? Well, okay. Welcome back, folks. Our story begins in the summer of 1518 in Strasbourg, Alsace, a town in what is currently France, but was at the time part of the Holy Roman Empire, a sort of supergroup of many continental provinces held together by a shared interest in shitting their pants about the Ottoman Empire and literal centuries of incestuous marriages.
They're the traveling Wilburys of medieval Europe.
Kind of, but instead of Tom Petty, they've got rampant anti-Semitism and banging their cousins, nieces, and nephews repeatedly until their genetic line is more like a knot.
That's worse.
In 1518, the Holy Roman Empire was going through some stuff. We're talking plagues, pogroms, and the invention of movable type, which would eventually lead to the mass printing, centuries later, of the Da Vinci Code.
Hey, I like that one.
What, you liked a book about wild conspiracy theories with no literary or intellectual merit? You, Ryan Bergara? I don't believe it.
Oh, you burnt.
That's so mean. A lot of people were into that book.
I mean, my abuela loved it. Then again, she also thinks Elvis Presley is still alive and running a small vacation resort in San Salvador.
Ryan and your abuela would have a lot to talk about. Europe was poised on the brink of change. The year before, in present-day Germany, Martin Luther published his 95 Theses, airing his grievances against the Catholic Church and paving the way for the Protestant Reformation. Over in England, Henry VIII was making googly eyes at a woman who was not his wife, and getting into dick-measuring contests with the young king of France over who had bigger calves.
So, a calf-measuring contest?
A strong calf is very sexy on a man.
Ryan, take note. If you keep skipping leg day, you'll never be the divinely appointed leader of a powerful European nation-state.
I don't hear you complaining.
Okay, well,
just the other day, you were telling me Ryan looked good in that shirt he was busting out of. You remember? The one with the teeny arms? Looks like a teeny baby would wear it?
Wait, what?
Say more about that.
Moving on! In Strasbourg, the past 3 years have been marked by devastating famines. Syphilis, bubonic plague, and English sweating sickness arrived in Alsace. Unable to buy bread or provide for their families, and unable to turn to an increasingly corrupt church for comfort, the people of Strasbourg grew desperate. Then, one day, in the middle of July, a woman named Frau Trophia stepped outside her home, took to the street, and began to dance.
What kind of dancing are we talking about here?
Yeah, like, was she, like, voguing?
Was it the monster mash?
Well, spoiler alert, it was a graveyard smash. By day, crowds gathered around the dancing woman to point and stare.
By night, she danced until her body gave out beneath her, sleeping only a few hours before rising with the sun to begin dancing again. No one knew for sure what had caused Frau Trophia's dancing mania. Some feared she might be a witch, others thought she was possessed by a demon. Still others believed that Saint Vitus, the patron saint of dancers, entertainers, and epileptics, had put a curse on her. The well-known Swiss physician and astrologer Paracelsus, who moved to Strasbourg in 1525, proposed yet another theory. He suggested that Frau Trophia's dancing was an effort to publicly humiliate her husband after a fight. Paracelsus writes, "In order to make the deception as perfect as possible and really give the impression of illness, she hopped and sang, which was all most distasteful to her husband."
I do that to Shane all the time.
Oh, yeah? Maybe you're out to dinner. He orders for you when you're in the bathroom. He orders the wrong thing.
I wanted the ravioli, Shane.
Only one thing to do. Gotta get up and start spike dancing until your feet bleed. That'll show him.
I like how this guy, what was it?
Paracelsus.
Right, him. I like how his main theory is basically the hips do lie.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that this dude believes all body parts of a woman lie.
After 6 days of this, her feet bloody, her body a wreck, and fear and speculation in Strasbourg at an all-time high, the city's officials put their heads together. They sent Frau Trophia to the nearby shrine of St. Vitus in the hills of Severn to supplicate for mercy. And it worked. Frau Trophia was cured. But by this time, the so-called dancing plague had spread. By the end of the first week, over 30 other citizens of Strasbourg had, according to Paracelsus, developed the voluptuous urge to dance. The dancers were, he said, free, lewd, and impertinent, full of lasciviousness, and without fear or respect.
Ooh, the voluptuous urge. He makes it sound so sexy.
Lewd and lascivious, come on. This creep's writing with one hand down his pants.
But seriously, put that on my tombstone. Here lies Sarah. She was free, lewd, and impertinent.
We love an impertinent queen.
Yeah, and Shane's without fear or respect, so you'll be a little matching set.
The city councilors put their heads together with local physicians to diagnose the ailment. Maybe it wasn't a curse of St. Vitus after all, they determined. Maybe it was hot blood, caused by an imbalance of the humors, the four bodily fluids, blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile, that they believed governed the human body.
Classic, classic medieval doctors. If this is a 16th century episode of House, imbalanced humors would be lupus.
Yeah, it does seem to have been their go-to diagnosis for just about everything. Fun fact, when we say people are full of bile to mean they're angry, we're even now calling back to the medical principles of humorism.
Chettle, you know I adore you, but that is no fun at all.
The doctor's prescription for this hot blood? More dancing. The city cleared an outdoor grain market next to a horse fair, erected a stage, and hired pipers and drummers. So that the people could dance away their malady, historian John Waller writes, the music went on day and night.
Wait, a horse fair? Are there horses just standing around watching the whole time this is happening?
I guess so. Can you imagine being a horse at that market? You're just hanging out, minding your own business, eating an apple, and suddenly this happens.
Yeah, you know, the horses would be, like, looking at each other, like, this can't be right. Like, should we do something?
If a horse was going to do a dance, what dance would it be? Would he do the whip? The, nay-nay?
He'd do the pony!
I love this horse!
This may shock you, but more dancing did not cure the dancers of Strasbourg. In fact, it had rather the opposite effect. By making the dancing a hugely public spectacle, the councillors had inadvertently kept the whole city's mind focused on the plague, and the number of dancers grew daily. Physicians could only watch helplessly when, a week or two after the beginning of the episode, the choreomaniacs began to die of heat stroke and heart attacks. According to one local merchant, Lucas Rem, about 15 people died a day. If accurate, that would suggest a total death toll of several hundred people.
Hey, everybody, come get a load of this shit. We got a mass psychosis over here.
Sure would be a shame if somebody else caught it.
Hey. I'm just really upset that the horses have to see this.
Within just a few days, the city councilors realized their mistake. They dismantled the stage and got rid of the hired musicians and dancers. Actually, they did a total 180, declaring music and dancing illegal within the city limits of Strasbourg for a period of 2 months. According to one Sebastian Brandt, the only exception to this rule was made to allow people to make music privately upon the celebration of a wedding. They may do so using stringed instruments, he writes, but they are on their conscience not to use tambourines and drums.
It's sort of like saying, okay, well, you can listen to Michael Bublé, but you can't have Lizzo.
I mean, no offense to Michael Bublé, but, like, why even bother living?
If I'm Michael Bublé, I'm fully offended.
You think Bublé is a big ruining history fan? Hey, Michael, if you're listening, we love your work.
The voice of an angel!
Armed with the knowledge that a visit to the Shrine of St. Vitus had cured Frau Trophia, the council decided to double down on their homage to the saint. They sent a team of masons, architects, and carpenters to Severn to build a new chapel and altar at his shrine. They also ordered the creation of a 110-pound wax statue of St. Vitus to be dispatched immediately to Severn.
Hang on. They made a giant dude-shaped candle?
Well, yes. Yes, they did.
That would cost, like, $700 from Nest.
Having sung masses for the afflicted, a pilgrimage set off for the Shrine of St. Vitus, the votive offering, and behind it, hundreds of dancers. Those who could walked. Those who were too far gone were loaded into wagons for the 30-mile journey to Severn. As historian John Waller writes, setting out under the city walls, the hired wagons must have made a diabolical sight. Dozens of distracted men, women, and children, eyes lolling, heads jerking, limbs twitching, and groans emanating from parched mouths and cracked lips, as mounted escorts rode at their side. It was an image to chasten all but the most hardened sinner.
They dance-walked for 30 miles? I'm such a lazy piece of shit that one time I had Amazon Prime Now deliver a new pair of headphones to my door because I couldn't be bothered to walk out to my car and get my other ones.
Once the pilgrims reached the chapel of St. Vitus, they were given crosses and fancy red shoes. Priests said mass over the dancers, anointing them with oil, and then each of the afflicted made an offering of one penny. And all this ritual seems to have worked. In the days following the mass pilgrimage to Severn, the dancing epidemic ceased, a testament to the power of suggestion. Seeking a cure to what they believed to be a supernatural affliction, only a supernatural cure would do.
Or...
No! There's no or!
Let the man speak.
Sarah?
Or they were actually cursed, or like, possessed, and the religious ceremony acted as an exorcism. From what I've read about demonic possession, it sounds really similar.
I lack Ryan's expertise on this, but it does sound pretty demon-y.
What expertise? He had to look up how to hold a seance on WikiHow in the middle of a seance. He put holy water in a squirt gun.
Well, that's smart.
It just seems like a big coincidence that they would do this whole ritual and at the end, ta-da, cured.
It's not a coincidence. It's the placebo effect. Come on, guys. I just laid out this whole case for mass hysteria, brought on by latent cultural belief in the supernatural and a society's underclass pushed to its breaking point.
I don't know, Shane. You can't prove it wasn't demons.
That's all I'm saying!
There was a dancing plague today in 2019, you'd all be dancing right now. You'd just be dancing and bleeding and making a giant man candle, and I'd be over here like, hey guys, I think it's fine? And then you'd be dead.
Ryan does have big Frau Trophia energy.
By September 1518, less than 2 months after Frau Trophia took to the streets to dance, life in Strasbourg had returned to normal. The dancing plague would never again return to the city, which some scholars attribute in part to the Protestant Reformation. As the people began to doubt the clergy who had ruled their lives for centuries, they came to doubt the saints too, both their power to curse and their power to heal. On the cusp of the scientific revolution, people were turning away from mysticism in search of a more orderly universe.
So this whole episode was a call out for me specifically. Shane, has 3 years of making Unsolved with me got you so frustrated that you had to do an entire ruining history episode about it?
It does seem like he's been thinking about this a lot, doesn't it? Is thinking the word I'm looking for?
Stewie, maybe?
Obsessing. It's romantic in an every breath you take kind of way.
He's got a shrine of Ryan in our closet, actually. Like, you know Helga from Hey Arnold? Only instead of worshiping it, he just sits on the floor arguing at it for hours.
Okay, Sarah, that's quite enough out of it.
Oh, just burning the midnight oil, practicing some zingers, muttering Ryan's name to himself over and over, begging him to embrace science and reason.
I mean, is it just me, or is this getting weirdly sexy?
Sarah's working on the opening chapter of her erotic friend fiction.
She just wants to be the little jelly filling in the middle of a Ghostbuster sandwich.
Is there, like, a waiting list for that?
Hand in mind, bucko.
All right, this is going off the rails fast. I'm calling this one. It's been fun. I hate all of you. This has been ruining history and also ruining Shane's life. Thanks for learning with us today, I guess.
I did learn a lot. More than I wanted to learn about Shane specifically.
Dude, are you blushing?
I said that's a wrap. I should have let them cancel this fucking show.
Very Little Changes. Written by Mithrigil. Read and cut down for length by Opalsong. Very Little Changes, at first. A child king is still not taken seriously by the Trade Federation. Two Jedi are still sent to negotiate and nearly murdered en route. They still make their way to Theed with the aid of a hapless local, exiled from her clan on dubious pretexts, and eventually secure an audience with both sovereigns of Naboo, the indigenous Bos Nass, queen beneath the surface, and the human king Amidala, 14 years old and terribly angry at the suffering of his people. Their ship is still damaged in the attempt to break the blockade, and they still wind up on Tatooine, at the mercy of a shrewd junk dealer. The king still poses as one of his own bodyguards, unrecognizable without his ceremonial paint. And Watto's pride and joy is still a tow-headed moppet of a slave, with grease on her cheeks and the force in her blood. The stars in the little slave's eyes when she falls in love with a glamorous boy are the same as they would be in any other universe. Annika Skywalker is a foundling, parentage unknown. Her father, Shim, confesses to Master Jean that he was never married, though he did have breeding congress with several human female slaves on the order of his old master. But no one in Gardula's entourage claimed responsibility for the infant, so it fell to Shim to find the parents. He did not succeed, and soon it was simply accepted that the child was his. The council senses in Annika much power and much fear. This, in and of itself, is unremarkable. Master Jin still protests their decision to refuse the girl training, and the council proposes that, instead, they train her for the healers or the archives and give her a temple position, and to wait to see if that power passes into Annika's hypothetical children. Some on the council do not find it horrific or objectifying. After all, they have seen their creshmates subjected to the same. But Master Jin reminds them that this child was a slave and would call what they consider an honor another form of slavery. And furthermore, the great power the girl possesses could be dangerous if left untrained. Obi-Wan Kenobi still watches her master die at the hands of Darth Maul. She still nearly falls, for multiple definitions of the word, and still slices the menace in half and casts her into the pit, and still kneels by Master Jin's side and swears to train Annika because Annika is the chosen one. Obi-Wan Kenobi has never in her life been chosen. Accepted and endured and humored and fought every step of the way as she negotiates a place for herself in a universe that does not bend to accommodate her. But never chosen. She still resolves to become the perfect Jedi. She has seen what becomes of those who the Jedi deem imperfect. The galaxy is sundered, whether a countess rules the separatists or a count. It takes the same 10 years for two Jedi to come to Amidala's aid again. The same sort of changes have overcome them both. Obi-Wan is growing out her Padawan cut, and it's somewhat unflattering. And she is the pristine and composed image of a perfect diplomat. And while Annika is grown tall and reedy, she is the furthest thing from subdued. She is taller than her master, lithe and lethal, but her face is still framed in innocent baby fat, and her eyes and lips still turned down with unbridled petulance. She still trips over her tongue when she addresses Nabert for the first time, and when he calls her Little Annie, even though she's an inch taller than him at least, her heart crashes to the floor. Some things never change. It is still decided that Annika will accompany Nabert as his bodyguard, and Oban will hunt Django. Two droids still stand witness to the secret marriage of a Jedi and a senator. He wears the finery that befits his position, she the coarse robes and raw silk that honor hers. Their hands still clasp, and one of hers is missing, replaced with cold metal and raw wire joints. Even on the happiest day of her life, Annika Skywalker cannot help but remember that her body is not her own. During the Clone Wars, Oban is tasked with one hazardous mission after another. She faces Grievous time and again, leads the 212th into battle, infiltrates separatist cells, and never loses the negotiator smile. She is briefly enslaved, but never broken. She fakes her own death to pose as her killer and saves the Chancellor's life. Maul comes after her again and kills her particular friend, the Duke of Mandalore. And Oban bears up under pressure because what else can she do? The perfect Jedi feels no suffering. The perfect Jedi has no attachments. The perfect Jedi does not dwell on the one when the many are in need. The perfect Jedi should never have had a particular friend in the first place. During the Clone Wars, Annika still takes and loses a Padawan of her own. Sokka is a spunky little firebrand at first. And of course he butts heads with his equally aggressive master. But they forge each other in their own fire and temper themselves in war. But Annika is no longer young and is more used to suffering. And Sokka is not, and the pressure catches up with the Padawan first. The council still casts Sokka out, 2 years into his apprenticeship, for a crime he didn't commit. The council took her father, then Oban, and now it's taken Sokka. Annika should know by now that nothing is hers. Annika and Nabert steal as much time as they can. Their relationship is still tested and doesn't always pass it. For all their love, there is simply too little time, too little understanding, and far too little trust. And yet, during the Clone Wars, Annika finds herself pregnant. It is impossible for her to hide. Oban knows before Annika begins to show, but is tactful enough not to insinuate who the father might be. They are still on the front, and by the time they can return to Coruscant, she's nearly halfway to her due date. She is not permitted to leave the temple until the council has pronounced its judgment. As a member of the council, Oban is there when Annika confesses that, yes, she intends to keep the child. She will not give up the name of the father and holds her shields against any attempts to scam for it. They dismiss her to the healers with concern and congratulations, and Oban remains behind. The council, Mace in particular, is reluctant to pull Annika from the front where she's so vital, but she's certainly entitled to leave and has been since her Padawan was dismissed. Yoda remembers, years ago, when it was suggested in this very chamber that Annika should not be trained and instead they should wait a generation. This is the opportunity they have sought. And so Yoda rules that in accordance with Jedi precedent, that if the father is unknown or unnamed, the child of a Jedi mother belongs to the Order. It is the origin of a fifth of the council, after all, Oban included. From their point of view, there is no shame, no theft, and no honor lost in such an act. But Master Jin is gone, and no one is there to remind the council that Annika may not see it their way. Shim is dead. Sokka is gone. Oban is the council's pawn. Nabert has just implied that Annika can't be both a Jedi and a mother. Annika has no one else to turn to but the Chancellor. The Chancellor who understands more about the hypocrisies and corruption of the Jedi Order than she should. The Chancellor who had children of her own decades ago and now governs the galaxy and has it all. The Chancellor who has watched Annika grow up with no personal investment in choice or prophecy, only genuine care. The Chancellor, the only mother Annika has ever known. But for all the things that this universe changes, Palpatine's thirst for power is not one of them. Such things transcend time and space. There is no need for dreams of dead lovers. There's no need for false insinuations that the Senator is unfaithful, at least not yet. All Palpatine needs is the entirely founded fear that the Order will take Annika's children away. She covertly steers her protege towards the archives and the creches. She drops rumors about Jedi eugenics and kidnapping. She mixes her advice on prenatal care and self-care with legends of miraculous birth, of the race of the Sith, of thousands of Force users around the galaxy that are not under the Jedi heel. She implies that Annika may have been conceived by the Force itself, or someone using it, and that the Jedi, warmongers that they have become, would channel that power into generations more of false peace and true pain. And of course, when Annika corners the council about this, it's all true, from a certain point of view. She does not have the children on Naboo. She remains under house arrest on Coruscant. She has not seen her husband in 2 months, and he is not there when Leia and Luke are born, in the Meta Center of the Jedi Temple. And perhaps if Oban was there, she would have taken Annika's lightsaber from her. Annika was not the only one that needed protection that day. She kills a dozen temple guards when she takes her children and flees. The Chancellor offers her sanctuary, of course, and promises to keep Leia and Luke safe. Darth Sidious reveals herself, and Annika kills Mace Windu. She kneels and takes a Sith title of her own and leads the execution of Order 66. The chief difference, this time, is that her children are here to see it. Palpatine is named Empress. Democracy dies with thunderous applause, and the bear stands witness. When he comes home, Annika is there, settling their twins into their never-used bassinets. He begs her forgiveness, and she says that the time has passed for that. But Nabaer must take the children to Naboo immediately. Annika will join them there once the Empress's position is secure. She's worked it all out. She can have everything the Order denied her. Her husband, her children, the true depths of her power, everything. And she can share it with him, if he'll only do this one small thing. It is, plainly, one last chance for him to earn back Annika's trust. It's a test. Nabaer fails it, but passes another by telling Oban everything. The fight still comes to Mustafar. Nabaer dies at the hand of his wife, smothered on the docks for his well-meant treachery. There's no ambiguity about it. No unconsciousness, no loss of will to live. The body is still interred and enshrined later on Naboo, surrounded by flowers and a false peaceful mane. Oban fights her Padawan through their wounds and tears. The battle still destroys the mines, drives lava up in geysers. They are still two Jedi, matched and in their prime, halves of a single whole. Annika makes that desperate leap and loses her remaining limbs for it. The supposedly perfect Jedi stares down the slope in horror at what she's wrought, at the burning, inhuman creature shouting hatred at the stars that Oban's years of selfless love have earned her. She stares and cries, and when she kneels to take Annika's lightsaber, she kisses the charred skin of Annika's brow and begs, "Please return to us, to me." The metal of Annika's remaining hand brands Oban's cheek as she slaps her away. The earth still breaks to separate them, and Oban still learns that she was never, and could never be, chosen. Instead of a life suit, the Sith apprentice is subject to elaborate reconstructive surgery. It takes months, Her lungs and limbs and eyes are replaced and new skin grafted. It is par for the course. Her body was never hers. Now it is more efficient, more machine than flesh, and machines can be repaired and replaced and recalibrated. Even if she can't claim it, she can control it. The Empress informs her apprentice that Oban killed the Skywalker children. She will still spend years searching her old master out, only for Oban to bring one of them back to set the galaxy right. The end.
This is The Dark Lord, a Marvel Cinematic Universe fanfic, written by Rhymer23, and read by and edited by Black Glass. And thus it came to pass that the Dark Lord was vanquished utterly, and all his workings cast into ruin. But evil can never be removed from the realms of men, and thus it was that the Dread Lord himself escaped through the veil that lies but thinly between the worlds, and came to rest in a new world, a ripe world, a world which he intended to subjugate to his will. And there he did wreak. Excuse me, Voldemort, but what are you doing on my tower? The Dark Lord was feeling somewhat buffeted by fate and heroes. I am emanating evil, he emanated. Could you go emanate someplace else? The mortal grimaced down at the drink in his hand. Scotch with added emanation. Don't recommend it. The Dark Lord felt that something had gone wrong with this conversation. It was a conversation. That in itself was wrong. Why me? The mortal said, with a martyred sigh. Why does every aspiring supervillain start his campaign on top of my tower? I chose this tower, the Dark Lord intoned, because it thrusts aloft like a deadly shard, penetrating the very heavens themselves. I thought the lord of such a mighty citadel would be evil indeed, and that he would become my chief lieutenant of evil, he clarified. I'm evil now? The mortal looked offended. Don't believe everything you read in the papers. He touched his chin defensively. Or is it the beard? If you will not join me, perhaps you will grant me aid. All I want is a nice mountain fastness. Doesn't have to be large. There I can reside and build my citadel, and from there spread my dread aura of darkness throughout the land, until the entire world is subjugated to my will, and languishing in hopeless despair and misery. Mountain fastness, huh? Mm-hmm. The mortal said. Go west, young, old being. West. The Dark Lord fell upon the word with relief. He drew himself up to ride upon the darkness like a great fell beast, with wings of living shadow that cast dread upon all living things that lay beneath its... Where in the west? He asked. Good question. The mortal waved his hand and summoned up the shining screen, upon which words were inscribed by a magic unseen hand. I'll show you a map. You can read a map. The next part of the night was confusing. It turned out that he could not. Well, the mortal said, go find your citadel. Take this, it'll help. He pulled something out of a drawer. GPS, he explained. Just do what it tells you. Now go. Go, you've got a world to subjugate. The Dark Lord took it and rose up higher than a mountain, higher than the stars, until the very world was filled with his terror and despair. You're welcome, he heard the mortal call far below him. When will I find someone who appreciates the things I do? Days passed according to the measure of the world, and the Dark Lord took up residence on a mountain in a place that men called the West. And there he did begin to build his citadel. And from there, too, did he summon minions and foul hordes unto him to execute his will and cast terror into the heart of all who beheld him. These minions were two, said the minion. There's only two of us. You can't call us a horde. And, point of information, the word minion might be considered unacceptably derogatory in this day and age. You might find it hard to recruit. I recruited you. I dragged you from your homes and enslaved you to my will by... Actually, the other minion offered. We volunteered. The Dark Lord did not like the second minion. He used a bow, behavior which was disturbingly elf-like. The Dark Lord did not like elves. We felt, evil, like doing some evil minioning. What do you look at me like that for, Coulson? But there will be more, the Dark Lord declared. Veritable hordes of them. When I have located the foul race of hideous distorted beings who skulk underground and delight in mindless destruction. They hide from me, but I will find them. If you say so, sir, said the minion called Coulson in a pleasing tone. But in the meantime, may I suggest that you make do with humans? And that means that I must endure this contract of yours, the Dark Lord said morosely. You need to clarify what benefits you're offering, said Coulson and Minion. Medical? Dental? The Dark Lord considered it. They can keep their teeth. I want them to rend the flesh from the bones of their enemies, not gnaw. And what measures are you putting in place to ensure the safety of your workforce? Consider these plans for a start, Coulson said, pulling out some sheets of paper. Human skin. No handrails. What if one of us fell off? The minion, who might not be an elf, cleared his throat meaningfully. What if I fell off, Coulson said. Or one of the hypothetical horde. Paperwork. Hours of paperwork. He had ruled a world, the Dark Lord reminded himself. He had ruled a world full of nice, normal, puny mortals who had done exactly what he had expected them to. Sometimes you only appreciated a thing after you had sent an army of minions to slaughter it, even down to its children's children. Coulson was still flicking through the sheets of skin, listing criticisms. Brimstone, tall pinnacles with external staircases, and no bathrooms. Hey, I like the pinnacles, said the possible elf. He sounded quite smug about it. You will be my chief lieutenant, the Dark Lord decided. Of evil, he added. Lately, he had felt the need to stress the word as often as he could. It didn't always help. Cool. Hear that? The elf turned to Coulson, smirking. Chief lieutenant. That's cheaper than you, minion. Evil, the Dark Lord thought, rather desperately. On a day when the very sky was weeping, the Dark Lord caused the first stone of his citadel to be laid. Ruin fell upon the earth for many leagues around it, and all the foul creatures of the earth were drawn unto the Lord and came to serve him and do his will. And so it was that the most dreadful of all monsters, a creature they called... What is your name, foul monster? The Dark Lord cried. The foul monster roared. The Dark Lord's citadel was scattered, all three stones of it. The Dark Lord turned hastily into a flying manifestation of dread and horror, but too late to save his toe from getting mauled. You serve me now, monster! Okay, grunted the monster. He had a monster now, whose name would haunt the dreams of children the world over. He smiled, a death's head grin that caused the marrow to turn to ice in a mortal's bones. No man was there to see it when the Dark Lord began to rebuild his citadel. But it is not possible for evil to rise unseen. Before many days were over, heroes began to arrive, for they had heard of the coming of the Dark Lord, and they knew that no man could live in peace until the Dark Lord was altogether vanquished and driven from the earth. And there they stood before the Dark Lord's, gate and... Do something, the Dark Lord hissed. That is to say, I command you to obey your Lord's will. Coulson looked up from his book. You never did agree to paid overtime. He returned to his reading. The chief lieutenant was busy cherishing his bow. Can't you do it? He asked. Dark Lord, ultimate evil, greatest power in the land. The Dark Lord rubbed the back of his neck with skeletal fingers. I had minions to do the actual fighting, he admitted, and sorcerers to do the sorcering. I had a mouth to do the talking. He came up with all the best threats, full of these and thous. Good talky stuff. Really, said Coulson, without looking up. I'm surprised. You're normally so eloquent. The Dark Lord mustered the full power of his forbidding mien. I command you! Yeah, yeah. His chief lieutenant pushed himself to his feet. Right on it, boss. You got heroes? I go smite. The heroes were waiting patiently outside the gatehouse that loomed at their ankles. It was a pitiful party of heroes indeed, consisting of only two. One of them a lady. He supposed her to be an enchantress, since warrior women always wore pointy undergarments made of metal and fought with most of their flesh exposed. The other hero wore a strange garb of blue and red, decorated with stars. From the stars, the Dark Lord knew that he was a mage. Go on, Cap, the lady urged him. Do your thing. We have come to oppose you, said the mage. Your evil cannot be allowed to go uncontested. You are a threat to the liberties of the free world. I, Captain America, have come to end your depredations. And I don't sound like that. The enchantress looked blankly innocent. I didn't write it. Destroy the minion, the Dark Lord screamed. Wrapping his cloak around him like wings, he surged into the air and became a fell creature, a dread shadow cast like the hand of death on the field of combat. Fighting happened below him, and at length, his chief lieutenant was triumphant. Hey, you up there, his chief lieutenant shouted. What do you want me to do with them? Throw the man in with the monster, the Dark Lord said. The lady is mine. I wish to interrogate her. And thus it was that the first heroes who thought to try their strength against the Dark Lord were vanquished utterly. The male, a powerful mage by his garb, was cast into the pit that contained a monster whose howls made even the strongest men quail. Oh, said the mage. Hello, Bruce. Hi, Steve, said the monster. Suddenly not a monster anymore. The Dark Lord would have banged his forehead against something, had he possessed a forehead and anything to bang it against. Although one triumph was snatched away from the Dark Lord's deathly grasp, victory was still his, for he held the enchantress, loveliest of maidens, in his grip, immured in his dungeon foul. And at night he came to her, and he put her to question in the most hideous ways that man can imagine. And she wept and said, and I never even wanted to be a Dark Lord. Yes. But it was the family business, and what can you do? And my father, he gave me no choice. So I found a little world, went and subjugated it. It was good, surprisingly good. The mortals all cowered when I wanted them to. That helped. But then I came here, and everything went wrong. Nobody acted the way they were supposed to act. Nobody gibbered. Nobody even cursed me. How can you be a Dark Lord unless people are afraid of you? She trembled. Somehow it only made things seem worse. I wanted to be a florist when I was newly spawned, he told her. Flowers don't talk about safety railings. Flowers don't ignore you and go pour themselves a drink. Flowers don't turn into naked men when you want them to feast upon a mage. I don't want to do this anymore. I can't cope with any more of this. His prisoner looked at him for a long while. At least you got an interrogation out of it, she said, as she shook loose her bonds and walked away. The Dark Lord started to sob. And thus was the Dark Lord vanquished. His realm ended forever, and his spirit broken. But then, just at the end of all things, I come to destroy thee, foul one. Hide not behind your minions, but come out and fight. The Dark Lord raised his head. A hero stood before him, dressed as heroes ought to dress, waving the sort of weapon a hero ought to wave, shouting the things a hero ought to shout. It was too late. Too late. I will wade through your minions as if they were but chaff. Boom the Hero. And then I will find the magic ring that is the source of your power and hurl it into the undying fire at the heart of your realm, even though my feet do not have hair upon them. Who let Thor watch the Lord of the Rings? Someone asked. He was asking why you called me Legolas, said another voice. I thought it would be funny. I will smite you with my mighty hammer, declared the hero. Too late, the Dark Lord whispered. Then he looked up at the whole disconcerting, hideous circle of them. No, please do. Please smite me now. He lowered his head and thought about flowers. Blue ones with yellow pollen, thick and sweet. Pink ones, as delicate as a dancer's gown. And the reason you didn't apprehend him the first time you encountered him is what? A stern man was asking, one eye covered with a patch. We were bored. Orange ones, he thought, as bright as the sun. White ones that fell in sprays of blossom, like feathers dancing in the breeze. Hey, we've defeated the manifestation of ultimate evil here. A little appreciation? The Dark Lord curled himself into as tight a ball as his incorporeality allowed, and gibbered. The end.
This is To Have and To Hold. It's a Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse fic, and it is abridged. We have Dr. Fumbles McStupid as Peter Parker.
Rena Jenkins as MJ.
Black Glass as Aunt May.
Got Wander Baskets as Doc Ock.
And Petica as J. Jonah Jameson.
And this was written by Train Cat. It started, as so many things did, with Spider-Man with the fight. Don't worry, May! Spider-Man shouted, dodging a sharp jab from a tentacle. He flung himself back. Just stay calm. I'm going to get you down.
Peter!
May called, reaching for him. One of Doc Ock's tentacles held her around the middle, leaving her hopelessly dangling 60 stories from the ground.
Oh, yes, Peter.
Doc Ock crowed, laughing to herself.
All those years guarding your precious identity. Now, one little slip...
May gasped as Doc Ock loosened her grip on her waist for a split second, then tightened it again.
And it's your family who pays the price.
She paused, thoughtfully.
Your very attractive family, on whose finger I do not see a ring.
What? Peter said. A tentacle slapped him across the face. With a frustrated growl, he grabbed it, yanking Doc Ock off-center. It wasn't a good move. He had to remember that as long as she held May in her sinister grip, anything that happened to her could have disastrous consequences. You leave her out of the sock. This is between you and me. Do you understand?
So, like, what do you do?
Doc Ock asked May, ignoring Peter.
Oh, you know, this and that,
May said.
I managed the feast center until one of your cohort blew it up. I don't know if you're familiar.
Doc Ock made an interested noise, though Peter couldn't tell if it was over the charity work or the explosions.
Honestly, his being Spider-Man takes up a lot of my time.
I can imagine,
Doc Ock said. They both turned to stare, quasi-accusatorily, at Peter. Excuse me? Peter said, we were fighting, remember?
I also dabble in electronics,
May continued, heedless.
I did a little work on those web shooters of his.
Fascinating,
Doc Ock said.
Not half as interesting as these arms,
May said, stroking the one that held her around the waist.
The way that they undulate.
You don't know the half of it,
said Doc Ock, and then flicked her tongue out against her top lip in a way that made Peter want to throw himself into heavy traffic.
Oh, you,
May said, like they were old friends and not in the middle of a hostage situation.
You know, this is actually refreshing. I don't meet as many people as you think, being Spider-Man's aunt.
You can't be his aunt,
Doc Ock said. She used a tentacle to twirl a lock of her curly hair around flirtatiously.
Tell me the truth. You must be his sister.
Aunt May giggled like a schoolgirl.
Oh, stop it,
she said teasingly, swatting a tentacle. What? Peter said flatly. Is happening right now. Aunt May batted her eyelashes. One hand held demurely to her chest. Doc Ock gave her a sly smile. Peter ripped a chunk out of the building's wall and threw it at Doc Ock's face.
It was very nice to meet you, Olivia,
May said when everyone was safely back on the grounds. Peter put his hands on her shoulders and pulled her back as the police surrounded Doc Ock, who was webbed up nice and tight. Do not wave at the supervillain, he told May.
Please!
Doc Ock shouted cheerfully as she was handcuffed.
All my friends call me Liv.
And do not call her Liv, Peter added.
We'll have to get together for dinner sometime, Liv,
May said.
Maybe after your arraignment.
Call me!
Liv shouted, one clawed tentacle waving back and forth in a weird mimicry of a cell phone as the cops forced her into the back of a squad car. Do not call her, Peter joked. I'm pretty sure they make you pay for those prison chats. He waited. There was silence. Aunt May, that was funny. Laugh now, please.
I don't know,
May said, handcuffed to her chin.
She is pretty cute.
Oh, Peter said. What the actual... The wedding was a lovely ceremony, held in a quaint outdoor venue strewn with white roses. Peter grudgingly walked May down the aisle, and then he sat in the front row, his arms crossed defiantly over his chest, and Mary Jane none too subtly elbowing him every other minute. He met each jab with a humph, distinctly reminiscent of his boss.
Behave,
she whispered. I'd rather be Sabretooth's personal groomer. He bit back.
You look like you're about to throw up a hairball either way,
Mary Jane noted. The music swelled. Liv appeared. There were fresh daisies dotting her wild hair, and she wore a white lace dress that fell in asymmetrical tiers to her ankles. Someone had decorated her Birkenstocks with rhinestones around the buckles. Her own tentacles were held to one side, prepared, apparently, to walk her down the aisle. Peter swore under his breath. J. Jonah Jameson, seated in the opposite row, promptly burst into tears. He buried his face in a monogrammed handkerchief as his wife patted his shoulder.
I just love weddings.
Gruffly.
Parker, why aren't you up there taking photos of the society page?
Maybe because it's my aunt's wedding that I am not working at, and because I am filled with hatred. Peter's interested.
Pictures, Parker?
Jonah sobbed, ignoring him.
I want pictures of this wedding.
For the love of, Peter said, tipping his head back. The wedding march started. Peter slumped deeper into his seat and attempted to glare a hole into the officiant's head. She was a small woman wearing a tie-dye shawl covered in feathers, and she opened the ceremony by having May and Liv use their energies to charge what she called the crystal of their love. Before the ceremony, Peter had asked Liv where she'd found her, and she'd said Craigslist. When the officiant asked if anyone had any objections, he sat up straight in his seat and opened his mouth. Mary Jane's hand gripped his thigh hard enough her nails threatened to puncture something.
Do not ruin this for May, she hissed.
She is Marion Dr. Octopus, Peter hissed back, flinging a hand out to furiously gesture at them. Oh my God, oh my God, they're kissing. Is that tongue? They were kissing. There was tongue. May dipped Olivia so low that the ends of her curly hair brushed the ground, and Peter automatically became concerned about everyone's backs. Applause broke out among the crowd as May and Liv straightened up, their hands clasped. Peter's own clapping was decidedly grudging and motivated mostly by the fact that Mary Jane had moved her sharp nails up threateningly close to some more sensitive parts of his anatomy. Later at the reception, Peter clinked his fork against his glass. I'd like to make a toast, he said, rising to his feet and clearing his throat obnoxiously. To the happy couple. Now, some people. Here he briefly paused for dramatic effect. Mary Jane muttered something unkind as she pinched the bridge of her nose. Some people might look at today's union and think, what is that morally ambiguous middle-aged scientist with a criminal record resembling a phone book in thickness who works for a company whose ethics I could, and have, best described as hot, wet garbage, doing, marrying my beautiful, sweet, kind, loving, naive 64-year-old aunts? He narrowed his eyes at Liv. She raised one hand and wiggled her fingers at him, beaming innocently. Some people, he continued, might say that. The optimistic among us, on the other hand, wish the happy couple nothing but a long, loving relationship filled with sunshine and happiness and all that jazz. Mazel tov. He downed his champagne like a shot, tossed the glass over his shoulder with a crash, and then leaned forward, hissing, "I'm watching you," at Liv, before he collapsed moodily back into his seat.
"Nice speech, honey,"
Mary Jane said, patting his knee.
"Very subtle."
There was a happy cry all around the guests as May pushed cake into Liv's face, then leaned in and licked her frosting off her cheek. Peter's face met his place setting with a dull thud.
"You were using me?"
"2 months," Peter said to the ceiling. "What did I give it again, Mary Jane? 2 months."
"It's been 5 months, Tiger,"
Mary Jane said, flipping the page of her novel. 2 months," he repeated strongly, pointing upwards.
"Using you is such a harsh term,"
Liv said.
"Just because I discovered you were due to inherit a privately owned atomic processing plant upon the death of your second cousin twice removed, and just because the wife comes before the nephew in the will doesn't mean what we have isn't real."
"I don't like this," Peter said, his head lolling against the back of the couch. He looked over at Mary Jane plaintively. "I do not like that this is my life right now. Make it stop."
"Just ride it out, sweetie,"
Mary Jane said, patting his thigh.
"Just ride it out."
"You were going to steal my inheritance and frame poor Peter for my murder,"
May said angrily, hitting Liv in the chest with her own diary.
"All right, yes, that was my plan at one point,"
Liv admitted.
"But was what we shared in the meantime not beautiful? Was it not in its own way precious? Did we not make steamy, passionate love that night in the Mediterranean?"
"God, please," Peter groaned, hands over his face. "Make it stop."
"I can forgive a lot, Liv,"
May said.
"All those times you tried to kill my nephew, I could live with."
"Wait," Peter said, his hand sliding slowly down his face. "You could what?"
"But for my own wife to lie to me for months?"
May continued.
"What happened to honesty in a relationship, Liv? What happened to us?"
"Can we go back to the part where she said she was okay with her trying to kill me all those times?" Peter said to Mary Jane, pointing at May and Liv.
"Ride it out,"
Mary Jane repeated, patting at his knee.
"Yes, I plotted and schemed. I'm a super villain. I can admit that. But then when I got close to you, when I really got to know you, it was you, May, that kept me coming back,"
Liv said.
"Your inner strength, your tenacity, that thing you do with your tongue."
Peter said, attempting to smother himself with a throw pillow.
"May, when I saw you make that man cry at bingo night,"
Liv said, her hand over her heart,
"that was when I fell in love."
"Oh, Liv,"
May said, her face softening.
"We have had some good times, haven't we?"
"I love you, May,"
Liv said, getting down on one knee. She stared imploringly up at her, her hands clasped together.
"Come with me. With my scientific know-how and your ingenuity and surprising knowledge of mechanics, we could take over the criminal underground. You could be a queen."
She paused, then added,
"All you'll need to do is help me kill your meddling nephew, and we're golden."
May picked up her baseball bat.
"Get the hell out of my house,"
she said. "Wait, ladies. Ladies, time out," Peter said, rising warily from the couch. May and Liv both stopped. Peter, walking to the alcove that housed the washing machine and the dryer, bent down and fished out his mask from the depths of the dryer. He tugged it on. "Okay, we're good. You may continue." Liv's tentacles unfurled from her back as May swung the baseball bat at her, and Spider-Man leapt daringly into the fray. Mary Jane sighed as she slid a bookmark into her novel and set it on the coffee table.
"I'll go find a lawyer who'll still take our calls."
She got up, ducking as Peter went flying by, and wandered upstairs. The end.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for all of your absolutely amazing live performances, and to our lovely audience. Thank you so much.
We aren't trolling you this year. You can go home.
Yeah.
At least not that I know of.
You're the one wearing the Daga shirt.
I suppose.
Our evening's entertainment.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Apparently the ConCom has cut the hot dog budget.
Yeah.
Maybe next year.
Shh. No official announcement. We're not officially announcing it. But that said, thank you so much, everyone. We will see you tomorrow, and thank you. Thank you and good night.
Good night.